Okay, this kind of feels quite timely to be doing the stuff on environment and climate apocalypse in this week of balmy weather, which seems to resemble a kind of unfolding climate apocalypse. Yeah, it feels very relevant.
Mike, can you turn the...
Yes, yeah,
no, okay.
Sorry. yeah, I think it's...
Should be good.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you, sorry.
So I just wanted to do two things today, I suppose, really. One was to sort of set Moore's thinking in its intellectual context and sketch his theoretical framework in kind of general terms and say a bit about where he's... the kind of, I guess, the longer history of his project, which results in this Capitalism in the Web of Life book, and then turn to look particularly at his kind of reformulation of Marx's concept of value and the way he tries to think that through in ecological terms. So as it says there, Capitalism in the Web of Life is published in 2015, but really it's the culmination of over a decade of articles that Moore produced exploring and outlining the concept of world ecology and various associated rubrics an argument. So, I mean, if you're interested, I really recommend reading some of the earlier articles. I think some of them are much more historically focused rather than the more kind of theoretical framework of Capitalism in the Web of Life. And I think some of those articles I actually find, you know, slightly more productive in some ways than some of the Web of Life, just because they ground their ideas much more concretely in kind of historical change. But it's out of those articles that Moore kind of pulls together all of his ideas and produces this this book. So in broad terms, right, Moore takes up the challenge of how we're to understand the relationship between society and nature, and more specifically between capitalist modernity and nature. But as you'll have seen here, he kind of immediately argues that even to start from that standpoint of society and nature is already to miss something. That we understand those two things, society and nature, as separate entities in the first place, is, he says, in fact the result of a particular historical process. And so he kind of goes on to make this argument about how society and nature both are specific configurations of human and what he calls extra-human relations, or we might call this kind of non-human relations, right? So both society and nature are both themselves always already the result of the way human and extra-human natures are entangled and intertwined together. And Moore kind of makes this argument on a grand scale, right? He's saying that human and extra-human natures are entwined at every level, from the microbiome and the body to global markets and world empires, right? At every level, humans and non-human natures are entangled with one another. There's always a relationship between humans and the rest of nature at play, kind of wherever you look, right? And so he then has kind of a particular understanding of history that follows from this, which is that history is always a relationship between humans and the rest of nature. To talk about human history or social history is necessarily to talk about the way relations between human and non-human natures have been configured and transformed over time. So in a sense, for Moore, it sort of makes no sense to talk about, you know, human history on this side and natural history on that side. Those two things are always, for Moore, intertwined. Human history is always natural history and vice versa. So Moore's, wider project is then to tease out the implications of that idea, and in doing so, he really productively, I think, yokes together the insights of environmental studies, environmental history, a long history of kind of left ecology, eco-feminism, and kind of eco-Marxism. So Moore's thinking doesn't come out of a vacuum. He obviously, he's drawn on a long lineage of, in particular, Marxist and more generally materialist perspectives on the relationship between human and extra-human natures, or the human and the non-human. And these have historically always set themselves up in contradistinction to idealist or, and this is obviously the specific object of Moore's critique, capitalist understandings of nature that emerged with and in relation to the way in which capitalism reorganized the world and kind of reorganized our relationship to the world, right? And these understandings of nature have tended to posit nature as everything that is not human. They've tended to draw an absolute separation between the human and the extra human. So that nature is all the stuff that isn't human, it's all the stuff that isn't cultural, it's, you know, nature is the kind of the stuff over there, if you like, and we're the stuff over here, and there's a, you know, a radical separation between the two. Often in those particular conceptions of nature which separate the human from the non-human, nature is presented as somehow ahistorical, right? Nature then becomes a kind of unchanging essence, while human history is precisely history, right? So humans are history, nature becomes just the background to that history. And that separation, of course, can be made to do all kinds of ideological work. Often, for example, it's used to obscure or exclude the history of, say, real concrete labour from the landscape that's then construed just as kind of external, unchanging nature. So the kind of the obvious examples, you can take something like the kind of discourses you get around, say, the wilderness or pristine nature, in this case, you know, this meadow, for example, which could be construed as somehow outside the human. You know, it's the world outside. It's all that's the rolling hills that are the kind of unchanging for decades or centuries. But you know, the kind of the argument that Moore wants to make is that, of course, this landscape, this non-human nature, can't be separated from a long history of human interaction with it. You know, the fact that it now looks like this isn't, you know, that's not something that has been like it for all time. That's the product of a long history of people working on that landscape. You know, centuries ago, that might have been completely forested. It might have then, those woods might have then been cut down to make way for small scale farming. And then at some point, those farmers might have been forced off the land with, you know, enclosures or something, say in the 18th or 19th century. And the land turned over to farming cattle, and then the fact that cattle are farmed on it accounts for the way in which trees no longer grow, and you get the emergence of things like the red clover here. You know, all of this long history of how that land has been made to interact with social and economic pressures, it's that relationship between human and non-human nature which produces this landscape as it comes before us, right? So it becomes impossible to say where human history ends and where natural history begins, or vice versa. You know, at any moment, it's difficult to say. You know, is that the result of the kind of the geochemical processes in the soil that mean you get that particular kind of grass? Well, yeah, that's part of it, but it's also the fact that that land has been farmed in a particular way, which means it takes on that particular has that particular ecological quality to it, right? There's no, it becomes impossible to separate out what's the result of human history and what's the result of kind of a non-human history. And it's a point that, you know, Raymond Williams has summed it up quite nicely. You know, we've mixed our labour with the earth, our forces with its forces, too deeply to be able to draw back and separate either out. It's that sense that humans and non-human natures are so thoroughly intertwined that it's impossible to say where one begins and where one ends. What we need to think about, says Moore, is the particular way in which those relationships are organised. That should be our kind of object of critique, our object of investigation. We have to accept that the human and the non-human are always intertwined. The question is, how are they intertwined and to what ends? Now, the idea that humans, obviously that kind of distinction between humans and the rest of nature that we see under capitalism has a long history that kind of predates capitalism, right? For, you know, there's a long intellectual history which is sought to think about the particular differences between humans and the rest of nature. And Moore's not denying that there are obvious differences between, you know, humans and a waterfall, right, or humans and a meadow. Moore talks, you'll have seen Moore talks about humans as a specifically endowed environment-making species, right? So there is a kind of distinction to be made between human nature and non-human nature. And as I say, that distinction has a very long history. What Moore is interested in is the specific thing that capitalism does with that distinction, where it turns it from a kind of distinction to a radical separation, right? And that radical separation is also a form of alienation. The specificity of capitalism is that it produces a certain kind of human subject, one defined in part through its separation from and domination over extra-human nature, which is then in turn understood as external, as an alien object to be contained, subordinated and exploited. So now, in that kind of understanding, nature now isn't merely distinct, but it's precisely an alien object, it's a commodity to be put to use in the service of production. The interesting thing, and Moore kind of says that particular sort of ideology of nature, if you like, nature as external, nature as an alien object, is, he says, the ontological counterpoint to the real and concrete separation of the direct producers from the means of production. So that ideology emerges out of the particular way in which capitalism reorganises labour as it comes to dominate the social world, right? The particular way in which labourers are separated from the means of production, you know, forced off the land, have their, you know, tools, their ability to manage a particular landscape in a particular way taken away from them. That separation of the producers from their means of production is entangled in the emergence of a particular ideology of nature, which sees nature as external and society as simply human. The interesting thing is that, and I guess the kind of paradoxical thing is that this Moore is arguing that human and extra-human natures are always intermixed. Under capitalism, the way this intermixture and their relations are configured produces an experience of nature and society as separate entities, right? So we tend to experience nature precisely as something that is, you know, outside of us, as something that is external to us. That's how we generally experience the world, right? And Moore is saying that's something that's produced by the particular way in which we are related to that kind of non-human world around us. So although we experience nature as an external object, that experience is produced by the particular way in which humans and non-human natures are woven together. This is what Moore is getting at here when he says, I don't believe society and nature exist, at least not in their dominant usage, humans without nature and nature without humans, nor do I believe that these are mere social constructions. They are rather abstractions at once violent and real. They're violent in the sense that they abstract too much reality in the interest of conceptual clarity, and they're real in the sense that society and nature are in fact operative forces, both in our knowledge structures and in capitalism's actually existing relations of power and production. So it's this idea that capitalism produces for us an experience of the world, and indeed produces the world, you know, things appear kind of as they are, in which nature and society are separated, but this split is itself an ideological construct resulting from the particular way in which humans and non-human natures are woven together, right? But that kind of separation, that which is an abstraction, nonetheless has real-world effect. So there's a sort of ecological version of commodity fetishism. It's a kind of ecological version, that idea of commodity fetishism, you know, that sense in which we experience the world in terms of social relations between commodities and material relations between people, which is an inversion of how the world really is, but it's also how we live the world. And this is that same idea in a sense, but in terms of nature and society. We experience nature and society as separate. That's an abstraction, that's an ideological construct, but it is also how we tend to live in the world, because, you know, that's the experience that's produced for us by the way in which the world is organised. And I flagged that up, I think it's important because at the end I'll come back to some of the criticisms of Moore's position, which tend to argue that Moore just collapses human and non-human natures into one. And I think actually he's doing something a bit more complicated than that, although he doesn't, sometimes he's a bit lax in terms of the way he phrases his argument. Okay, so Moore has this, so against the kind of what Moore calls a dualist ideology that treats nature and society as singular abstractions, Moore elaborates his theory of world ecology, which understands humans and non-human natures as intermixed and intertwined at every level. Now, Moore's not alone in kind of arguing for a conception of nature and society as a dialectical unity. As you know, as I've said, he's drawing on this long lineage of in particular, left ecologists and eco-Marxists. But what Moore says is, you know, we've got this this kind of long history of theoretical work on the way humans and non-human natures form a dialectical unity, and that's great. That's what we need. The trouble is that when it comes to people writing histories of, say, you know, capitalism or of particular historical periods, even though we know, you know, we might, you know, theoretically we know humans and non-human natures are always kind of intertwined, when it comes to writing history, we tend to separate those two things back out again. So you could have all these great theoretical claims about, you know, humans and non-human natures, they're always dialectically related. But when you come to write the history of the emergence or rise of capitalism, for example, those two things still tend to get parceled back out. And so what Moore's interested in is this question of how do you tell a kind of world historical narrative? How do you produce a historical narrative that takes seriously that idea of humans and extra human natures as always imbricated in one another? And this is what drives Moore's desire to move from thinking about the environmental history of capitalism or of capitalist modernity to thinking about capitalism as environmental history. So Moore wants to get away from what he calls the kind of consequentialist approach to history, where you say, you know, capitalism emerges, Moore follows the world systems line of thinking, which sees capitalism as emerging kind of over the kind of long 16th century, so from the sort of late 1400s through to the 1600s, Moore kind of says that's the period in which capitalism emerges as a world system and begins to consolidate itself. And Moore's argument is that often that story is told in this way, that capitalism emerges, it transforms the way people labour on the landscape, it transforms that landscape, it has lots of terrible effects on the landscape, it has lots of bad consequences for people and landscapes. But to tell the story in that way is just to think about, you know, there's capitalism over here and it has a series of consequences over there. And that simply reinforces that kind of dualism between human and non-human natures. You've got, you know, humans doing stuff over here and it has bad consequences for nature over there. And Moore's question is, how do we actually tell that history in a different way? How do we you know, take seriously that idea that humans and non-human natures are always entangled? So this is one version of the history that Moore tries to tell in order to think it a little differently. So as I say, Moore follows world systems theorists and seeing capitalism as emerging over the course of the long 16th century. But for him, the emergence and spread of the capitalist world market over this period isn't simply about joining areas of the globe together in new relationships increasingly predicated on commodity production, market exchanges, wage labour, and so forth. Instead, he argues that by bringing into a single division of labour formerly isolated or only kind of loosely articulated areas of the world, capitalism entails a kind of epochal reorganisation of global ecologies. So the integration of societies into a kind of uneven world economy, a global economy that is joined together by trade and the movement of commodities and labour and so forth, that isn't simply just a social process, that also involves the linking together of ecologies and or ecosystems in new ways that produce what he then calls a world ecology, that produces a world economy that is simultaneously a world ecology, a place that involves the linking together of different landscapes, of different ecosystems in new and systematic ways. So one of the examples he gives is precisely this, you'll have seen this map, or some version of it before, I'm sure this is the classic triangular trade, right? The movement of goods from Western Europe down to West Africa, where they're traded for slaves, which are then sent across the Atlantic to the Caribbean and the Americas, and work on things like sugar plantations, producing goods which are then sent back across the Atlantic to the UK. Right, it's the classic kind of triangular trade. This is often held up as one of the kind of defining moments in the emergence of capitalism and the linking together of these different societies, these different places into a new kind of world market, right, predicated on the flows of commodities. And Moore's argument is that that's all true, but what's also going on here is the integration of all of the ecologies of these different places into a single system. So the transformations in landscapes in England, say, become absolutely and fundamentally intertwined with transformations in landscapes in West Africa or in the Caribbean, and so on and so forth, right? So, the manufacturing of goods in England, that involves, coal mining, for example, the massive transformation of landscapes in England. It involves deforestation, the cutting down of wood for fuel, to build boats, to transport these commodities, and so on and so forth. You have huge transformations of landscapes in England that then get linked to the transformations in landscapes that occur in West Africa as a result of the slave trade. As the slavers come down to the coast of West Africa, they're forcing communities further inland as they try and flee the slave traders. It disrupts existing sort of agricultural patterns, existing societies. It involves a fundamental transformation in landscapes and lifeways in West Africa. And then, of course, once slaves are captured, they're sent over to the Caribbean, where they're put to work in sugar plantations, which themselves have involved the rapid deforestation of islands in the Caribbean, the reduction of biodiversity with the imposition of sugar monocultures, and this huge kind of landscape transformations that are going on here. And that then produces sugar, which is kind of sent back across the ocean to England, where the profits are used to fuel the Industrial Revolution, which of course involves further massive transformations of the landscape. And at every stage, you've got different bits of the world being drawn into this matrix, right? So the slaves on the plantations, they're fed on cheap salted fish. It's because it's very cheap, obviously, and the slave owners don't want to spend too much money on keeping their slaves going. And that cheap salted fish is being got from the North Atlantic. So you have these trawlers that are going out into the North Atlantic and catching lots of cod, which is being sent down to the Caribbean. So all of a sudden, the North Atlantic gets pulled into this new system that's emerging. So these transformations in the North Atlantic, those cod stocks are very rapidly depleted, actually, and the trawlers have to keep going further and further north to find more and more cod to feed the plantations, right? So more and more of the world is kind of sucked into this new system that's emerging, and you gradually get the intertwining of all of these different ecosystems, all of these different ecologies into a single system. And for more, that's the emergence of the capitalist world ecology. So it's this idea that the emergence of the capitalist world economy, this linking together of the world through commodity flows, is simultaneously the linking together of different ecologies, different ecosystems, into a single system under the kind of domination of a capitalist logic of production, right? A capitalist logic of value. Okay. So I guess I just then wanted to say a bit about Moore's particular take on the idea of value under capitalism and his reformulation of Marx's theory of value. So we can return to this meadow, right? And we can say that, let's say that this meadow has been bought up by an agribusiness that decides to produce wheat on it, to kind of mow all that grass down and start to produce wheat. So to do so, it hires a tenant farmer, this guy here, who the agribusiness obviously has to pay for his labour, right, in the way that wage labourers are paid for. And as you'll know from doing the Marx, I guess, in term one, the value of that farmer's labour power is then determined by the amount of socially necessary time required to reduce his, to reproduce his labour power, his physical existence. Okay, so the agribusiness pays for the value of the farmer's labour power. It also, of course, pays for the various bits of machinery and so on that are needed to produce the wheat. And you end up with a bundle of wheat, which the value of which is determined by the amount of socially necessary labour time required to produce it, which includes the value of the farmer's labour and the value of the machinery and so on that was required to produce that wheat. Okay, so that's, I guess, the kind of the conventional understanding of value, right? That there's a certain amount of labour power required to produce a commodity that determines its value. But the point is that Moore wants to make is that the production of a bundle of wheat, a particular crop of wheat, is dependent upon this wage labour, this kind of paid work for sure, but it also is dependent upon whole streams of work or energy that the capitalist doesn't necessarily have to pay for, the agribusiness doesn't necessarily have to pay for, right, but which is still essential to the production of that wheat. So that includes things like the biophysical processes that reproduce soil fertility, you know, so the actions of worms dragging in dead leaves and so on, helping to produce the fertility of the soil, none of which, of course, the agribusiness pays for. Those are things that are happening underneath the soil, but they're absolutely integral to the production of the wheat, right? They're integral to the replenishing of the soil's fertility. It's dependent upon the actions of bees, right? That pollinate plants. It's a huge amount of agriculture that would just collapse if the bee population collapsed, right? It's that process of production is just dependent upon pollination provided by bees. But again, it doesn't have to pay for that, of course, in general. It just, these are things that are happening around it. It also is dependent upon the domestic labour required to reproduce the work, the kind of unpaid work that's done in the home, the cooking of his meals, the kind of emotional labour that's required. I imagine that guy requires a lot of emotional labour to kind of, reproduce him so that he's, well enough to go to the field each day, right? There's kind of a lot of unpaid labour that's going on in the domestic sphere to ensure that farmer can go to work each day. And Moore's point is that when we think of the value of a particular commodity, for sure that value is determined by the amount of labour time that goes into it. Moore's not dissenting from that particular kind of Marxist understanding of value, but he says, we have to recognise the way in which that value is predicated upon a whole series of things that are unvalued, that are unpaid, but which are absolutely essential to the production of value. So all of this unpaid work that's done by both humans and non-human nature. So the unpaid work done in the domestic sphere, but also, you know, the unpaid work of non-human nature in terms of things like reproducing soil fertility, aid in pollination, and so on and so forth. The point is, you know, these things don't produce value in and of themselves, precisely because they're unvalued within a capitalist society, right? It's not that we might think that, you know, according to some other schema, we might say that the work of bees or work done in the home is very valuable in, you know, according to some other criteria. You know, it's things that we might want to and celebrate or say is valuable. But at least according to capitalism's specific criteria of what counts as valuable, you know, these things go unvalued, and so they can be appropriated for free. That's Moore's key point, right? Because this stuff is unvalued according to capitalism's logic, capitalism can appropriate it for free, and so it's crucial to the production process, because it's basically lots of free stuff that goes into the production process that capitalism, you know, by definition, then doesn't have to pay for. So that's all great. The problem that capitalism then has is that, as I'm sure you've seen last term, it has this tendency to want to commodify all areas of life, right? That it has a drive towards wanting to commodify everything it comes across. Partly, of course, because by commodifying things, it can turn them into something that can be bought and sold on the market, and so turn things into something that can turn a profit, and you know, that's the ultimate sort of raison d'etre of capitalism, right? So capitalism has this drive to want to commodify all spheres of life, and so it begins to commodify those processes of reproduction done by both humans and non-human natures that had previously existed outside its immediate circuits of production, right? That had previously existed as unpaid work outside the logic of the commodity. Capitalism begins to draw them into its logic and commodify them and turn them into things that you do have to pay for. So, for example, say with the fields, you know, say after 3 years, perhaps, this agribusiness, because it's, you know, desperate to turn a profit, it's relentlessly you know, farming the field, relentlessly kind of growing wheat upon it. And after a few years, it's exhausted the soil fertility, right? It's just sucked out too many nutrients out of the soil. And at that point, it has to begin to add fertilizer to the soil. Whereas before, it could rely on the existing fertility of the soil and the work of, you know, worms and other microbes and so on to kind of reproduce that soil fertility. After a while, it's exhausted the soil so much that it has to begin to pay for fertilizer to spread on the soil in order to keep up with its kind of production schedule, you know, to keep producing the same amount of wheat. And so all of a sudden, something that previously, you know, the agribusiness had got for free, the fertility of the soil, all of a sudden it's having to pay for that now. And that, of course, raises production costs and reduces profits. And this is Moore's, for Moore, this is a key kind of problem with capitalism. It's a key reason for capitalism's periodic crises, right? That capitalism relies on all of these streams of unpaid work, but it has a tendency to exhaust them, to overexploit